What's the date?
Today is December the 11th.
Okay. All right. So you want me to go ahead and start?
Go ahead.
December 11th, 2012 in Berlin at the Winter Simulation Conference. We're here to interview Mike Pitt, who's with the Lancaster College or University. Lancaster University. I'm Bob Sargent with Syracuse University, and Jim Wilson from North Carolina State University will be interviewing Mike. Mike, why don't you tell us where you went to school and for college, undergrad and graduate?
Okay, mine's quite complicated because I was originally an engineer. I went to Brunel University in West London, where I did what you'd now call industrial engineering. In those days, it was called production engineering because there was a heavy manufacturing emphasis. But actually, it was an IE course.
Well, that's what typically in England they call it, production engineering.
Yeah, they did. It's now, you know, you talk about manufacturing engineering now. So I did that. And then actually, I went to Birmingham University to do a master's in OR. Now, the honest truth is the reason I went to Birmingham University because I've fallen in love, right? This is the real truth. Okay. In my undergraduate education, I decided that I was no good as an engineer. I mean, academically I could do it. I found it quite easy, but I decided I wouldn't be an engineer, and I did an OR course in my final year, which is the fourth year, and discovered that at Birmingham University there was a master's in OR for which I could get a grant and money. And the woman who later became my wife was a medical student at Birmingham University, so there was a neat fit here. So I went to Birmingham University. Okay, you know the way that people have this view of how their life is planned. Well, mine's been a bit of a zigzag line. And so I did that master's in OR at Birmingham. Then what I did is I went out and got a job, and I worked for Cadbury Schweppes in Birmingham, making, you know, where they made chocolate and where they made soft drinks. And so I worked there for a few years in OR, as we called it then, and doing mainly what we now call marketing analytics. That's what I did. And then after a few years there, I decided I could revolutionise the university system. Okay, so I decided I'd get a university job for a few years and then go back into industry for a real job. Okay, so I was never intending to become an academic. I had no long-term plan to go into OR. Okay. And so the simulation story will be quite similar. Now, in those days, you didn't need a PhD to get a lecturing job in a British university. Technically, you still don't. But almost no one's appointed without. So it's a very different system to what it is now. So then I got this university job at Aston University in Birmingham, where I stayed for a few years. So that's the start point.
Okay, so do you have a PhD now?
Yeah, I have a PhD now, yeah.
So why don't you tell us where you went to school, get your
PhD? Lancaster.
Lancaster.
I did it whilst I moved to Lancaster, okay, after a few years at Aston. I moved to Lancaster because there was a big OR department with about 20 staff, 20 faculty, whereas I was in a small group of about four or five at Aston. And when I moved to Lancaster, I've done a PhD there as a member of staff.
So you got a master's in operations research. So when did you first get exposed to simulation? When did you start doing simulation?
Well, okay. This is another quite interesting story. We did a bit of toy simulation when I was an undergraduate engineer. Now, you've got to think this was 1970, okay? And the university had one computer, an Elliott 803, okay, which was punch tape. You guys know as much about this as I do. So you never got anywhere near this. This was left for the high priesthood to play with. So we did a few hand simulations, you know what it's like, with a simple MM1Q. And then when I went to Birmingham, one of the courses I had to take was a simulation class. And the guy who should have taught it was a guy called Alan Clementson, who you tried to contact me about. Now, Alan, at the time, was a senior lecturer at Birmingham, but he was on sabbatical leave in Australia. So he didn't teach the class. I was taught it by another guy whose name I won't mention, okay, who was not entirely up to speed, I don't think. So there were about 25 of us in this master's group, and I don't think anybody got a program to work. Okay. So I don't know if you remember those days. You had a program, you sat there with a hole with punch. You send it off, and then you waited a couple of days, and you got it back.
You had fortune in 2 days, yes.
Yeah, so that's the story. So actually, I finished the master's degree at Birmingham without ever really succeeding in simulation. And then when I was at Cadbury's, I didn't go anywhere near simulation. Not in a, actually it's not true, I did some marketing simulations. And when I went to Aston as a lecturer, without a PhD, remember, without any research track record, the guy who was head of group said, can you teach this simulation class? Okay. Well, you know what it's like. So you sit there with this book and you work your way through it. So that's how I got into it. And because I'm, well, somebody stuck this, you can't, I better say this, but on the bottom of my ribbons for this conference, there are the proper ribbons like session chair and speaker. And then there's another one that says know it all, which my wife stuck on the bottom. Okay, so I had this view that I could do something about simulation education. So I ended up writing a book on it, and all then the story unfolds. But initially, when I started to teach the first class, I knew no more than I could read about the day before.
Okay, so tell us, you mentioned you wrote a book, so why don't you tell us about the book or books that you've written?
Well, okay, I've written several. The first one I wrote was a book on simulation, computer simulation in management science, which was written really because by then I'd been teaching and doing a small amount of research in simulation for about 4 years. And the book I'd started with was it Naylor? I think Naylor, yeah, was the first book that I started,
yes,
with, which was very correct. And then I looked around at the other texts available, and what was happening at the time is that mainframe computing was giving way to personal computers. So we all, well, a group of us had Apple IIs, okay? And so what we were doing was writing simulations on Apple IIs and actually earning some money.
What time year would that be?
This would be about 1980.
Yeah.
Okay, we'll continue. We're trying to get some dates tied in.
Yeah, no, that's right. So around 1980, personal computers started to become, in the UK, widespread, a bit behind the States. And we managed to get our hands on a few of these things. And we realised you could do real work with them. Okay, they weren't just toys. And so some of us started writing simulations in BASIC on these, on these little Apples. And it was amazingly powerful. You could do stuff. And of course, this is before fancy graphics or anything like that. So then I got more interested, and I thought, heavens, actually, this is the way things are going to go. So it's obvious that if you're going to write a book, this is how you target it. Now, if you look at that book from, but it was 82, you know, it's got lots of code in it, it's got BASIC in it. You know, the assumption was somebody had to write code to produce a simulation. Now, times have moved on since then. But that was the starting point, thinking, you know, my students, this is what they're doing. So writing as if we're writing Fortran on a mainframe is no longer sensible. And actually, very few British universities had simulation software packages that worked. They had flaky little things that didn't always work. So the ability to have your own computer, write your own code, get the stuff back at you quickly was a complete revolution, I think. For me, it was. Anyway. So that was the genesis of that particular book. And then the others...
Well, can you comment on other? Before you do that, sure. What impact do you think that book had on?
I really don't know.
Did other universities pick up?
It got picked up very widely outside the US. Some penetration in the US, but rather less. And that's not surprising given the way publishers work. But it was picked up in Western Europe, in Australasia, in Britain, and so on. So it's been. It's now out of date. You know,
it's out of date, but the time it did have an impact.
It had a great impact. I mean, it ran to 5 editions. Eventually, after edition 5, I got very bored with it, as you do. It's just a chore, really, updating these things. So I gave it up about, where are we now, 2012. I gave it up, I think, about 6 years ago. I thought, I had enough of this.
Okay, so now tell us then a little bit more about your other...
Oh, sorry. Other books. Sort of like a serial writer. Simulation has always only been one of the things I've done. Now, you can say that's either because I'm a scatterbrained and can't concentrate on one thing, or because I just prefer to keep broad. But I've always also been interested, and in fact the first research, you know, we have research councils in the UK that provide funding. It's like the NSF in the States. So when I was still at Aston, and this is again a comical conversation. I'm called in after about 2 years to see my head of group, Steve. And he says to me, he says something like, "You really ought to do some research." Fine. So I said, "How do you suggest I go about it?" And he said, well, you can either do a PhD or you can get a research grant. And I was so naive, so I said, well, tell me about research grants. So he explained, you apply, you might get it, you might not. If you do, you can employ somebody. I thought, this sounds good. So I applied for a research grant for what was then called the Social Science Research Council. And I got it. And this was looking at how people in OR go about structuring the problems they tackle. So it was a step back from the modelling end. And that produced 3 papers or something like this, which, to my surprise, still get cited about once every 2 years. I presume people just feel they ought to. They never read the stuff. And so I got into how people structure problems in the days when what in the UK became soft OR was beginning to emerge. Now, I was never mainstream in soft OR, but I was always interested in how people go about framing issues that they tackle. This then led me to an interest in modelling. And as part of my teaching responsibilities, at one stage I was running the MBA programmes at the university. And because I was running them, we have academics running programmes, not administrators. I thought I'd better do some teaching on this programme. So I actually ran a module, which is essentially an introduction to OR, but I don't mean just doing some LP, just doing some simulation. It was a bit more than that. And out of teaching that class, I realised there was no book that I could use. So when I had a chance, I wrote a book called Tools for Thinking, Modelling in Management Science, which is it's third edition at the moment. I don't think I'll do a fourth. Again, which has been used a lot around the world, which is an unusual book because it tells you about modelling. Then it gives you a section on an intro to various techniques like discrete simulation, like system dynamics, like decision theory and so on, but also has some softer stuff in the back to try and integrate the two. So it was trying to say to MBA students, you know, if you're quantitative or if you're qualitative, some rational analysis is going to be reasonable, really useful to you. So that's what happened to that one. Do you want me to keep going?
Yes.
Yeah, okay. I then was interested in how hard and soft quantitative and qualitative stuff work together. So I got some money, some more research money, to develop a network of researchers where we were looking at, if you like, soft methods and hard methods is how we refer to it. So that resulted in a book called Systems Modelling Theory and Practice. And during that period, I started doing some work for the what was in the UK called the Inland Revenue, the tax people. And we were doing a large study, a group of us, where we were examining how personal tax is collected and analysed in the UK, about which I knew nothing before I started. This is really quite a successful project. So and then I became what's called a Whitehall Fellow, and Whitehall being where government is. So I was funded for a while as a Whitehall Fellow to do some work with the Inland Revenue. So I got interested in what we think of as public sector. Then what happened is the UK research community put together a scheme called the Advanced Institute for Management Research, and I became a research fellow in that group, looking at how to measure performance in public services. Okay, which I never quite finished. I never quite wrote the thing up properly. But out of that, eventually, I wrote a book called Measuring the Performance of Public Services, which came out this year, published by Cambridge. So I've kind of sort of morphed around. And sitting around this in the middle has been, if you think of us kind of line oscillating around, sitting in the middle has been an interest in modelling and in simulation, particularly discrete simulation. But one of the reasons why that initial simulation book sold quite well, I think, was it actually had, I think it had 12 or 13 chapters, of which I think 2 chapters were intro material. I think then the next group were on discrete, and then it had 3 chapters in the end on system dynamics.
And what?
System dynamics.
Oh, yes, system dynamics. Industrial dynamics,
yeah,
yes.
It was the only book which seemed to put the two together, which I think is why it sold, actually.
Yes, well, it's come back now.
Back into simulation.
Yes. Yeah. So let's go back, if it's all right, Jim, and ask him about the simulation. So when you started doing your simulation, you know, in United Kingdom or England,
yeah.
You did the activity scanning worldview. In the United States, we did the event worldview. So what was you teaching, and what did you put in your book regarding worldviews?
Well, the worldviews, in fact, there is a bit of a misunderstanding here, because actually in the UK, the dominant approach was what we call three-phase, which Tucker, Katie Tucker, Keith Tucker, sort of developed. It's never very clear whether it was his idea or somebody else's. There was a guy who worked with him who drank too much, whose name I can't remember, who was full of ideas. It's never very clear where this thing came from. But essentially, this ended up with, instead of being activity scanning or event routines, it was a halfway house. So what you did is you took your activities, which were the transitions that took time, and you divided them into two groups. Those that you could schedule directly and those that you couldn't. And so what you did is anything you could schedule, you scheduled on your event list. If you may not have event list, you can do it another way. And then as a consequence of those directly scheduled activities, Bs, you then dropped into a set of things which could follow one another, and then you repeat scan until you finish it. So you end up with something which is actually rather more simple to program than a set of events, because you don't have to think about the interactions. But the it's faster to run than an activity scanning, which is too slow. So that was the dominant thing. And if you look behind software like Simulate, they're not here this year. Underneath it is a three-phase ABC approach.
Okay, so why don't you tell us a little bit about some of these people that you may know, Clemenson, Tucker, and so forth. So why don't we take, some of the early people. Pardon me?
We're recording this.
Yes, no, but I mean, what did they do?
Okay, well,
what were their people, sure, what were the personalities like? Because, this is history, they're deceased,
Well, Clemenson I knew on and off as somebody who didn't teach me. In the sense, because he was in Australia, but with whom I had lots of correspondence and contact over a period. Alan was extremely sharp, a Christadelphian as it happens, and so he had a slightly strange view of life. And I think without, I'm careful what I say here, a pretty abrasive character, okay? But he was really hot at what he did. Now, what Alan had done is he'd taken this language written by Esso called CSL, Control and Simulation Language, which was a classic expressive simulation language.
Excuse me. Keep going.
Alan had taken CSL, and actually, which originally was written as an interpreter. So originally what happened is CSL was interpreted, and so it essentially generated Fortran. It generated Fortran, and then the Fortran was compiled. Alan decided that this could be improved, so he developed this language, Extended Control and Simulation, ECSL, which is nothing special. It was just CSL slightly enriched, which was directly compiled, I think. What he saw was that coding is slow and error prone, so if you could develop an automatic code generator, you could save time. And the British scene, based around what you think of as activities, tended to look at activity cycle diagrams. So Alan realised fairly early on that if you could describe an activity cycle diagram to some kind of program generator, it could generate code for you. So he developed a CAPS, I think it was called, Computer Assisted Programming System.
Yeah, there was a CAPS.
There was CAPS, though. CAPS ECSL, which he produced, I think, around 1970, I think, around when he started it. It was written in Fortran, if I remember, but it didn't generate Fortran. So it generated templates of ECSL code, and then the notion was that you as a user would then edit that code to make it more sophisticated. It never really caught on, except in the research community as an idea. And of course, we take things like that for granted now. But I think he was the first one to do it. So it wasn't the same as the original. What am I thinking of? What was the. My brain's going. What was the IBM system? Think of a well known system.
GPSS.
Because GPSS, in essence, of course, was also based around a flow diagram notion. But actually, your flow diagram description was the program. Okay, whereas with ECSL, your flow diagram description was not the program. The program was generated by the program generator itself. So there's more than a difference there. So that idea, it didn't really catch on commercially, but it did catch on in the research community. and led to quite a few other things. So that was what Alan was doing. He was quite a strong character. I had an undergraduate student, very, very bright guy, who just went through everything, top marks. And Nick wrote a user manual for ECS, for Capt ECSL, which we gave to Alan. I thought it was a pretty good piece of work. Alan tore it to shreds. Okay, now, fortunately, the student was a very strong character, because it was a pretty good piece of work, I thought. And actually, what the system needed was a hand-holding thing. That's exactly what it needed. Now, of course, the problem is, and I've known this in a number of people who've done really seminal work in different areas, is if you've done the seminal work, it's hard to let go. You want to protect it as it is. And that's what Alan did. And it's a real shame, because it meant ECSL stayed where it was. And what happened later was that Alan was at Birmingham University, and the OR group there started to fall apart. And so their funding started to go. And so there was a big shakeout about 20 years ago now, where the OR got merged in with mechanical engineering and just got lost. So Alan quit. He then went off and ran a guest house in the English Lake District for a few years. And Bobby Wee met me last week. So I set about trying to find out where he was. And I found people who had heard from him in the last 5 years, but we've been unable to find out where he was. But he's certainly moved from running the guest house back into the West Midlands near Birmingham, but we don't know where. We don't know if he's alive or not. But a very, very sharp character, incredibly bright.
Okay, now you mentioned the CSL language. Now, who really created the...
John Buxton, and I forgot his name, Lasky.
Harold Lasky?
Yeah, I'm not sure of his first name, before my time, who were at Esso. And they were, essentially, it was about moving tankers around the world. So you have very long activities.
So you got any comment you made about the language or the people?
It was a classic expressive language, so you could say things like find first tanker in Portsmouth, move to Dover. So that's the kind of thing you could say. And of course, those things like Portsmouth were sets. So you're looking for set membership. In a way, it was a database language, really. Because actually, a lot of simulation languages really are database languages. And so your entities were organizing to sets, and state changes were shifting from set to set. And so what you needed was some kind of language which easily expressed those set manipulations. And then behind it, of course, you've got a time-based executive.
So did you ever meet Buxton?
No, never. And Buxton was a serious computer scientist. He later moved to the University of Warwick, where it became head of computer science.
I remember the name in the operation research literature and stuff.
Yeah,
I never met him either, but
Me neither. He was still at Warwick when I first moved to Aston. But I don't know if he's still alive.
I don't believe he's
extremely bright guy. And in those days, it wasn't that unusual to move from industry to university. It's less common now than it used to be. And people would move backwards and forwards. Lasky, I don't know anything about at all. So that was the CSL history. And then, of course, alongside that, you've got Tock.
Yeah, well, say who Tock is.
Keith Tocker, who originally trained, I think, as a statistician.
Yes, that's correct. Yes. He was a statistician, and he worked for a steel industry.
That's right. I think he's his PhD at Imperial College in London. And Tock, he was always called Tock, even to his face. His real interest was in the fact that if you view a simulation as being a set of stochastic variables and they're interacting through time, you end up with a distribution that you essentially it's not tractable. So Tock's interest really was in finding a way to get at that output distribution which is constantly being realised through time. That's what he's interested in. And so he came across, I don't know how, that a simulation could do it. So, and if you've read the history, you'll know that he always thought simulation would disappear.
Really? No, I didn't know that.
Oh, yes. He was convinced that as statistical methods improved, you wouldn't need simulation.
Well, because he wrote the book, the first book in simulation.
He did, called The Art of Simulation. But he was convinced that the need for it would disappear. As we got cleverer and as we built on the shoulders of more and more giants, then the statistical community would come up with methods which would make it unnecessary. That was always his view. Okay. Now, so he got into it as a statistician. Now, of course, in those days, now I'm not quite sure of the timing of this, computers were things you got your hands on if you possibly could, but these were rare beasts. And he happened to be working, I think, partly in defence as well, and got his hands on some computers and found ways of programming, I think, probably in assembler or autocode, what we would think of as simple simulations now, and got interested in it. And somehow or other, I wish I knew how, ended up working for the steel industry. It's not clear what happened. Tot was the kind of guy, if you sat with him, if he talked to you, because if he didn't like you, he wouldn't talk to you. Okay. There would be ideas coming off left, right and centre. He just wouldn't stop. Okay. So this guy was just full of ideas and also knew how to implement them. A rare talent. But I am told, not a very good manager. Okay. So actually, he formed a group in the steel industry in Sheffield, which recruited some outstanding talent who did a lot of the work developing GSP, General Simulation Program. But the group wasn't that successful in business terms. Whilst he was there, he was a part-time professor at Lancaster. And later in that period, the research council, the science research council then, gave us some money at Lancaster before I arrived there to develop a research centre in simulation. So there was a simulation research centre based at Lancaster University. Tock was the research director, part-time, working in industry. And the day-to-day director was another extremely bright guy called John Crooks.
I've heard the name, but yeah, John
is still alive. John again is. I don't know if you ever knew Stephen Mathewson.
Yeah, well, I was going to ask you. That was another name I was going to ask you about later.
Stephen tells me the story of coming up to Lancaster to do a seminar, and for some reason staying in a caravan on John's property, and describing it as being like a kind of intellectual health farm. So John was a guy who, again, was just spinning ideas off left, right and centre. If you went for a conversation with John, you came away really not quite sure what he was talking about, but it sounded quite important. And if you went and puzzled away at it, you got something useful out of it. So, but John had a serious failing, which is that he refused to write things up. Now, this is during the time when the university sector in the UK is undergoing an enormous transition. In that the people had decided research productivity was too low, which it was, and so there was really no emphasis on publication. And when that emphasis started to come through, John refused to play the game, which is disastrous.
That was John who?
John Crooks. That's John Crooks.
John Crooks.
So John eventually retired early, which, from my point of view, was a great shame because John was a great colleague. And so full of ideas, that an incredible guy. So John had been the day-to-day director of the Simulation Research Centre, with Tock as the nominal research director, but part-time from industry. And that arrangement didn't really work, I don't think. It didn't work. So I don't think that centre was as productive as it should have been. It became an offshoot of the steel company, really, where Tock was working. And so the software, Tock had this notion you could write an equation-based simulator. Now, what did he call it? He'd got something in mind that people were struggling away with, and it never worked. So that sort of died and hit the sand. Now, later, Tock then left the steel industry. He'd already left Sheffield, and a guy called Stafford Beer took his place. You ever heard of Stafford?
Oh, Stafford Beer's book. Yeah, he wrote a famous book, yeah.
Stafford was an even worse manager than Tock. They could pick up in that company. A visionary, really, but not a man for detail. Tock was a man for detail. So Tock moved out of that. He then moved to, still in the steel industry, but he moved to Birmingham for some reason. And then after that, he then became a full-time professor at Southampton University in mathematics.
But he didn't live too long after
that. No, he died. It's really sad it was.
Because I had him come and talk at the at Hamburg, as a matter of fact, in a session for me.
And he was a good speaker and a very incisive mind. He was a great fan at one stage of Bernie Arizona.
Ziegler.
A great fan of Ziegler. He thought Ziegler, whom he found hard to understand, he thought Ziegler had probably got it right. So I spent quite a lot of time after that trying to understand Ziegler myself. I think I got there. I think Debs has got some good ideas.
Well, it's good. You talked about two people so far, Clemenson and Tucker. So you mentioned Matheson's and John Crooks. Let's go through one at a time and tell us what you may know about these early-time people.
Well, John was a colleague at Lancaster.
John
Crooks.
Crooks, yes.
And he, as I say, ran this simulation research centre, which never really, I don't think, achieved its potential, I'm afraid. I wasn't part of it. It was in its last stages when I moved to Lancaster. And I was just a junior academic anyway. I mean, I was a nobody, so nobody would have listened to anything I said. But the great thing about having that simulation research centre is we got lots of kit. And of course, kit was expensive in those days. And so having lots of kit was fantastic. So I was a parasite sitting on the edge of this research centre using their kit, which was fantastic, really.
And what do you mean by the kit?
Kit. So computers.
Oh, kit.
Our own computers.
Oh, okay.
You know, so in the department we had Data General Mini, a small department, we had a Data General Mini, we had various Apples of different, we had all this stuff sitting around. And so, you know, where other people were fighting for computer resource, we just had it. And it was out of that that book emerged, thinking, hey, this is the way things are going to go. It's clearly the way things are going to go. So from my point of view, I think what John's big realisation was, though he didn't write about it, was that the personal computer revolution, it wasn't called that then, was the way it was going to go. Now, Brian Hollocks.
Yes.
Another name for you.
Well, yeah, I've emailed him trying to find...
Okay, well, Brian is worth talking to if you can. You can always do a Skype conversation with Brian. I think he's now retired. Brian was an unusual character because he went to work for Tucker in Sheffield in OR without having done a degree. No undergraduate degree. I knew Brian socially through my elder brother, but I had no idea what he did when I was in my teens. Not a clue, just he was Brian. And then later on, I discovered what he did and discovered that he was doing simulation stuff with Tom. And in the... There was a paper in the Journal of the OR Society, which I think Brian wrote, called something like OR in the Age of the Micro, which sounds so dated now. I think that's what it was called. You can check it. So Brian, I think, wrote that paper, certainly did some of the work for it. And Brian also saw that... These were not toys. They may be restricted now in terms of memory, processing speed, all that kind of stuff, disk access, but these are for real. So that kind of immersion, and Brian was involved with that, and he stayed in Steele doing mainly simulation work. He produced, I think it was FORSS, F-O-R-S-S, Fortran OR Simulation System, I think it was called FORSS. And this took GSP, Tucker's system, and I think made it work in Fortran, basically. Which nowadays you'd think is trivial, but it took longer. And he also saw the need. He knew about Clemenson's stuff. And he saw the need for friendly front ends, so started to play around with graphical ideas. And this eventually, indirectly, led to Witness.
Okay, yeah, Witness was there, and that was one of the first that had graphical interfaces.
The first one that had a graphical interface was, I think, in the US. And I think I've referenced it somewhere. Julian Wrightman?
Julian Wrightman did it, but I was thinking of England. The Witness came through when I was thinking of England.
GPS,
That's right. Now, this is all around 1975, I think.
I was going to say about 1980.
And now what's his name? Warwick University, Bob. It'll come to me in a minute. Anyway, there was a guy at Warwick University who was playing around with the idea of visual interactive simulation. So not just not just displaying the results of a simulation as you go along, or running them as a movie afterwards, but actually of interacting. So the notion being that, as we now take for granted, you stop, you start, you change values, you move sliders up and down. But of course this is running crudely on pretty much on mainframe computers. Now Bob Hurrion, H-U-R-R-I-O-N, Bob Hurrion, again, very bright, never got promoted beyond senior lecturer, totally unsociable, very good squash player, with the world's worst filing system. Bob came up with this idea of visual interactive simulation. So he'd gone to Warwick University without a PhD, as I'd gone to Aston and then Lancaster. Whilst he was there, did a PhD, and his thesis was on this visual interactive simulation. So he wrote this VIS stuff, which was then taken up by two companies. It was taken up by the motor company, which is then called British Leyland, who then formed a computing offshoot called BL Systems, which became ISTEL. So they took up the ideas, and they wrote some software called CY.
Yes, I remember that. CY. Yes, CY. Okay,
so they wrote CY, and CY essentially was written between them and Bob Hurrion, I think. And it was a set of Fortran routines that on certain kinds of computing devices enabled you to interact, slow, stop, speed up, watch things as they go along. And then in parallel with that, the steel company were spinning off a business which didn't work, which Brian Hollocks was involved with, which took Force, F-O-R-S-S, and turned it into a sort of graphics thing, which didn't really take off. I can't remember what it was called now. But in the States, actually Witness came from the States.
Really? I thought that was always England, because people had spoken at conferences for yep. me always was from
well,
England.
Well, Brian Hollocks is the one to talk to on this, because I might be wrong about this, but my recollection is that the steel company had formed this computing offshoot, the name of which I can't remember now, and it had a small link to the US, and one of their US staff had seen Force and some of the graphics running and said he could do it better, and I think he was the one who came up with the idea of a palette, point and click palette, which would then I think in the earlier days it generated code like ECSL did, so this is where these things come together. And so I think it was a code generator, and then people took up that idea and said, "Oh, okay, if we can do this interactively on screen, we don't need a code generator. In essence, we go down the GPSS type route, where the screen is the program." So that was going on. So I think that came from the US, but I'm not absolutely sure. Brian Hollocks is the one to ask on that. Now, also at the same time, there was a guy called Edward Fiddy.
Never heard of that one.
F-I-D-D-Y. Edward was an upper class gentleman. Okay? Edward's demeanour was that he owned Britain. Okay. Very self-confident man was Edward. Edward had been working in the steel industry with Brian Hollocks and Tocker. Saw the potential in these ideas, so started up another business, which was given the name Insight International.
Oh yes, Insight.
Yeah, Insight International. It was called International for some reason, though it was based in Britain. And they had some software, the name of which I can't remember, but it took exactly the same ideas. It was a point-and-click palette, and it essentially generated a running.
Well, I think it was called Insight. I think that was the name of the product.
Yeah,
I'm not sure, actually.
I could find out. So Edward was around. And so at that stage, there were three companies selling similar kind of projects. There was what later became ISTEL, which became LANA, selling CY, which became Witness. There was the steel lot selling, I can't remember what it was called now, became Witness. I'm sorry, I'm getting mixed up here. This is where this gets very confusing now, these threads. And Edwards was selling this other product, and there wasn't room in the market for all three, so gradually there was mergering taking place. Now, out of Insight International came Mark Elder.
I'm not familiar with that.
You don't know Mark? Simulate, the software. Some software called Simulate, which is widely used in education in the UK and sometimes in practice. SIMUL number 8, Simulac. They're not here this time.
They're often at WSC.
That's right, they usually are, but not this year for some reason. Now, Mark had worked with Edward Fiddy in this Insight International. And Mark's an entrepreneur, and he got bored with working for somebody else. And for some reason decided to take time out and become an academic. Okay. Partly because he'd fallen in love. This is really what it was about. But so he moved from where he was living to Glasgow because he'd moved in with this, I won't say who it is, no, they're still together, Val Belton. And he got a job as an academic. Had to do a PhD because he hadn't got one. So got on with it, and during that developed what became Simulate. He then realised there was a commercial potential here, so he essentially went down to very part-time, started up this business, which now I think employs about 30 or 40 people, something like that, with American and various other offshoots. So Simulate came out of his work with Insight International, with their product. And then these then came out from steel, and you've got the motor industry, and there was lots of mergers going on. So we end up eventually, by these different routes, with Witness, which is what Lana now sell. But also, if you go downstairs, Saker Solutions, who are downstairs.
What's the name of you?
Saker, S-A-K-E-R.
Okay.
I've forgotten the name who runs it. It'll come back. But the guy who runs that business was in this in the early days. Now, he had a big bust-up with Lana, and so went his own way. He's been running Saker for about 7 or 8 years now, quite successfully. And he was in on some of these developments, so he might know. I can't remember his name. It'll come back to me in a bit. So some of these people are still around. I think the emphasis on visual interaction did come from the UK. I think the first version of Witness didn't, but I'm happy to be corrected. And actually, for a while, this is around the time I started to get involved with WinterSim. No, a bit later than that. I used to come to the WinterSim events and look around the vendor hall and thinking, this is so out of date. And I wasn't sure that was me being arrogant, which is what my wife would say. But it did seem very, very dated to me. There was a different kind of emphasis from the way things were moving in Western Europe or in Britain. But of course, since then, you know, all the big products have come out of the States, you know, and you've taken over this area. And I don't think, to be honest, in terms of anything, there's not much new happening in that area at the moment, as far as I can tell. You know, it's just people doing similar things in slightly different ways. So does that make sense?
Well, we haven't really discussed Matheson yet.
Steve Matheson, okay. Steve was a lecturer at Imperial College. Fell in love and married an American woman, still together. I think he's a doctor. Steve, around the same time as Alan Clementson was writing CAPS ECSL, this interactive generator, Steve was writing a similar system called DRAFT, D-R-A-F-T, DRAFT. Now, DRAFT was a general purpose program generator. So what he did was he isolated the, it was again activity cycle based, with a slightly different notation, and he'd organise it so that it could, if you fed it with essentially what it had a set of code fragments in a database, and the code fragments could be Fortran, they could be whatever language you want, really, as long as it was a similar form of language. And so DRAFT was designed from the bottom up to generate multiple language source code, but it was the same idea. Produce an activity cycle diagram, describe it to a system in some way or other. Later it became a point-and-click description rather than text, and it generated code which you could then edit. So exactly the same idea. Stephen never succeeded in commercialising it, and gradually I think got bored with it, and later moved to work for Imperial College decided that the OR group, management times group there, wasn't what it wanted, so it squeezed people out and created a business school. Stephen got frustrated during that process and left and worked for what we think of as the Civil Aviation Authority. Okay, so this was air traffic modelling. So he then moved to CAA, and now does a bit of consulting work. But he's now, he must be 70, I'd have thought, Stephen, something like that age.
He's still alive, you think?
Still very. And I got an email from him a month or so ago. I'm not sure what it was. I can't remember now. It's somewhere in the depths of my email system is an email from Stephen. And so he certainly was alive this year. And he's quite a character. Definitely very interesting to talk to. And he was certainly in this earlier than I was. I'm just the only one that survived long enough to coming to Winter's Inn.
So when did you start becoming active in WSC?
Oh, the early 90s. Well, what had happened was I had actually... Yeah, I can remember now. Yeah. Okay. What happened is I was getting a bit frustrated with... I'm not sure whether Informs existed. Was it Informs in the early 90s or was it...
It was still Institute of Management Sciences and the Operations Research Society.
That's right. And there was a call for papers, I think in a new journal. It might have been Computing, or whatever it's called, Orson Computing Journal, something like that.
Yes, it was the Orson Computing Journal in the early 90s.
Right.
Yes.
Were you involved with it?
No.
Good, I could say it.
No, I was not.
Okay. I remember looking at the call for papers, and I noticed that there was no mention of simulation at all. By then, I'd become a simulation freak. Okay, if it moved, I simulated it. If it didn't, I hit it till it moved, and I simulated it. And I thought, goodness me, is this also journal? No mention of simulation in this stuff at all. So I wrote a letter to somebody or other in the days when you wrote letters. And I think for some reason I got an email back, I think, from Osman Balshi.
Okay.
Basically said, you are quite wrong. There is this enormous community in the States. And you've never been to the Winter Simulation Conference. You should come. I'm hereby inviting you to write a paper. I need it by this date.
Okay? That sounds like all the
truth. That's Osman, okay. So I can't remember, it was early 90s sometime.
It would have been the 1990 Winter Simulation.
No, it was a bit later than that. It was certainly later than 19. It might have been 92 or 93, something like that. And so I took up the challenge and wrote this paper, which was actually on object orientation, because I was into coding and object orientation at that stage, and I developed a few systems that were object oriented. And so I came and did that paper, found, hey, there is a community here. Hey, these are human beings. Hey, they're interested in the same things as I am. So for me, this was quite an exciting time, other than wandering around the hall and thinking this is all a bit old-fashioned, really. So that's how I got involved here. So I had no knowledge at all of this. Now, you must realise that prior to 1990, probably prior to then, transatlantic travel was fairly expensive. And there weren't the special deals there are now. And so actually there was, my guess is, if you analyse the attendance at Winter Sim, it was much more US than it is now.
It's become certainly international.
So, yeah, and I heard of the thing. I thought this is just an American thing. I'm not interested in this, really. So that's how I got involved. And in fact, Stephen Matheson had told me about it a year earlier, because I'd written an edited, or I'd written part of an edited book, which I then edited on discrete modelling. And Stephen had written a chapter in it, so we chatted about it. So he put me onto Winter Sim, but I ignored it, and then Osman was in touch with this challenge.
Now, I was going to bring up a little aspect about the statistical stuff, but do you have anything else you want to follow up on this?
Well, there. As long as you're talking about various people, it's obvious that you had quite a lot of interaction. For instance,
England, Britain's a small country.
Yeah, yes. But I'd like to mention at some point if you have any recollections or comments about Jeffrey Gordon or Ole Johan Dahl or Kristen Nygaard.
Right, yeah. I mean, I was aware of Gordon's book. Now I think about it. When I was thinking about writing that simulation book back in the... about 1980, I talked to various publishers, and one of the publishers said, well, why don't you just take one of the American books and sort of anglicise it, bring it a bit up to date. And I thought, no. And somebody mentioned Gordon's book, so I had to take a look at it. But I never met him. And the Dahl-Nygaard stuff is quite interesting, I think, because they really were the ones who came up with object orientation, really. And I never used Simula, though I learned to read it. I never used it.
So you, well, that was Argol based, right?
That was Argol.
You never, Argol never really picked up in England, did it?
Well, it was a British thing, really, Argol, but it never really made the mainstream because mainframes in those days were primarily IBM, really. And I'm not sure there was even an Argol, any kind of compiler for the 360, 370 series, which is what most people had. So it never really made it beyond the academic community. And actually, Argol, one of the versions of Argol, had, was it 68, had some rather interesting features about re-entrant code. You could play around with it, which you couldn't in Fortran. And it's that that made Simula possible. And so I read about that early on, didn't understand it, had no idea what they're talking about. And gradually it started to make sense. And then I happened to have a PhD student working with me who wanted to do some computing-based stuff. Didn't complete a PhD as it happens, and so the two of us got into what would it have been, probably C++ in the early days of C++, and so that led us down the route. So since then I've always, if I have to code, it tends to be either in Visual Basic or some object oriented stuff for the two different ends. So I never met those people, I'm sad to say, because I think these were, you know, great thinkers. And most of the point-and-click stuff relies on that now.
Yeah, well, it made major contribution to computer science.
Absolutely, yeah. So. And it was the days when, if you like, simulation was ahead of computer science rather than the other way around. And that's what I used to say to students. There was a day when that was the case.
You got another question, Jim?
Go ahead.
No, I was going to say, as I look at you know, the contribution of England, they're very heavily into modeling and simulation languages in the early days that are leading up to that,
but I
don't ever see much, even though Tucker came from a statistics, I don't see really any really innovative early papers or anything
on
the
right.
statistical
I
side.
Right. I think you're right. It's to some extent, there's never been an enormous British contribution on the analysis methodology side. Part of it, I think, is that probably most people who participate, say, in Winter Sim from the UK would be from the ORMS community. And historically, I think that's had a greater practical bent than in the US. Partly, I think, because the UK universities were less bothered about publication, whereas in the US, you know, publication has always been the key to promotion, hasn't it, really? At least for the last 50 years, 60 years. That wasn't the case in the UK. And so, so therefore, there was less need for people to write. So people were writing very different kinds of things. Now, and in a way, there was a rather unfortunate divide, now looking back at it, between stats and OR. So the statisticians went one way, and the OR people went another way. And it seems as if they'd never meet. Now, this is changing now. So if I can bring an up-to-date thing, at Lancaster, we now have a joint PhD training centre called STORY, which is Stats and OR Industry or something like that, which takes in about 10 doctoral students a year. And they're jointly supervised. They do a first taught master's. And then they're jointly supervised by somebody from Stats and somebody from OR. And this is, and about half of the PhD projects are industry sponsored, so that they're paying the whack. So we've got about 30 of those on the go at the moment, and this is a deliberate attempt to try and bring the two things together again. So it's beginning to happen. But yes, you're absolutely right. The British contribution in the analysis side has been really rather thin. And we've been typically rather. I think part of it is that you know, if you're teaching, a first course in simulation, or even a course in simulation where you want students to have some useful skills, the reality is, a lot of the analysis methodology stuff isn't that useful. Okay, not all of it by any means, but a lot of it isn't. And so there's been a tendency, I think, to stay as far as teaching goes, at the, I wouldn't say the introductory tutorial level, but intermediate tutorial level. Now, to remedy that at Lancaster, I see Barry Nelson's coming back with us later this week, and Barry's going to do a masterclass with our story students on up to do with analysis methodology, a whole day masterclass, and then doing a seminar and things before he goes off to Estonia. It's something we are very much aware of, that it's an area where we've been rather weak, which is interesting, isn't it? Because actually, in the world of statistics, Britain has produced some pretty good statisticians. Is that a fair comment?
Well, I'd like to kind of ask you about Peter Lewis. Do you know about Peter Lewis?
Yeah, of course I know about Peter Lewis, but I'm not saying the Britons are better. I'm saying it seems to me to be a real paradox that now I look back at it, that we've had these heavyweight hitters in statistics who've never really engaged with this community. And it might be the Tocker thing where Tock was in a way slightly embarrassed about simulation. It was what you did as a last resort. You couldn't do anything else. And so I think it never really engaged with that mainstream stats community. With whom now, Monte Carlo methods are just a major theme. You know, very, very major theme in that stats community. And if you're linking that with Bayesian methods, it gets quite horrendous, really. So there's a huge amount going on now, but it doesn't link into this community. And I guess the same in the States, isn't it?
But in my view, Peter Lewis is sort of the most prominent example of a world-class statistician who made significant contributions to simulation methodology.
That's right. But it's not been an area where we've been that hot, really, I think. Whether that will change, I don't know.
Well, you mentioned that government-sponsored center, they give money towards doing simulation, but it was off on the modeling and the language side versus on analysis side.
It wasn't. When you think about Tocker, that's rather strange. Now I reflect on it. Because given his background in statistics, that's not where he pushed it. He thought simulation would go away. It was very open about that. I can't make sense of it either. And I think I'm trying to think who else is. There's nobody here who's old enough to remember this. But
we talked somewhat about research. Maybe you might ask some more questions here, but I want to talk a little bit about application. Do you have anything on research?
No.
You mentioned you have industrial projects, with the university. But it seems to me that in England, simulation, in some sense, got in the steel industry and came from other areas. So could you talk about, the driving force of application or the spread of simulation in the real world in terms of solving problems, if you have any knowledge in that
general area? Sure. If you think about the time when computing emerged as an affordable resource, which was the 1950s, wasn't it really, when I was this big, what was going on in Western Europe, very different from the US, is reconstruction. Much of Western Europe was, if not destroyed by war, seriously damaged. So primary industries were where the emphasis went. So steel, getting steel working, all that kind of stuff was really important. And it's also what happened in the UK is, I think it was 1948, but again, I wasn't really around. We had a Labour government elected. And what the Labour government did was nationalise the primary sources of production. So the steel industry was nationalised. Steel was a bit later. So the coal industry was nationalised. So I think around 1950, the National Coal Board was created out of all these small operators. And the National Coal Board was the area of economic activity with the largest OR and management science group. It had over 100 people. And a fair amount of simulation work went on there, because making mines safe, working out how to get stuff out properly, all that kind of stuff. And so that was going on at one level. The steel industry at that stage, in fact, hadn't been nationalised, so there were independent companies. But they had heavy government subsidies, and they were into improving production efficiency. So that's where simulation found its home. Rather than in queuing systems as such, much more in that area. And later the steel companies were nationalised, and out of which came the Hollocks and all that kind of stuff. So a lot the early simulation work was mainly in primary industry. So you're looking at steel, you're looking at coal, you're looking at oil. So you've got SO writing CSL. So that was where the emphasis was, if I recall. I think there were some things in aviation, but they wouldn't have been serious stuff. There would have been small models. And really, I think in terms of industry, it didn't really take off until software became cheap and easier to use. So it's only when the witnesses of this world start to appear that you get this more widespread use. So nowadays, in the OR type world, which is where I come from, in the practitioners, they regard simulation as being just another thing you do. That's it. The toolkit's available. Do they do it very well? That's a different question altogether. So that's what happens. So actually, I think the early emphasis in the UK and the US is probably very different. My impression is it was primary industries, and these were big organisations that could afford computers, because that was the other issue, wasn't it? So when in my first job in Cadbury Schweppes, I was put onto a project partly because I was the only person there who'd ever used a timeshared computer. In my undergraduate stuff, I'd used a timeshared computer, and so I could write code because I could sit at this 10 character per second terminal. Do you remember those?
Oh, yes.
Okay.
Very well.
Okay. And somewhere in the world, we call it the cloud now, was this computer which answered me. So I was the only one that could do it. So if you think about the rudimentary computing resources, and of course, if you look at the early steel stuff, Tucker's stuff, this notion of stochastic gear wheels, these were hand manual simulations moving counters around on a board. And I used to do this with students when I taught my first class. We'd draw on a board and we'd move counters around to learn how to do it. So I think it's not a surprise it was primary industry. There was a national need. There were large bureaucratic organisations which had computers. And so that's where you're going to find the practice happening. And only as computers became cheaper, as software became better, did this tend to spread out into a wider community.
It was very interesting. I was sitting here thinking about, you know, how it was going in industry, but it appears to me fairly early on it was in universities and it was teaching courses in some sense, even though they may not have great computers. So it seems to me the education world was getting it into people to go out into industry.
It was, but if you think about my experience, which is not that unusual, on the master's course in Birmingham, which was aimed at producing practitioners, okay, was that we did this simulation class, which I think lasted 30 hours or something like this, 10 weeks, 3 hours a week, where I don't think any of us got our program to work.
Yes.
Okay. So you, therefore, you don't go out into industry thinking, this is something I'd like to do. You go out thinking, I think I'd probably better not do this because I'm going to do a lot of damage. So actually, it didn't produce a confidence at a practitioner. Okay. And that was certainly the case with me. I mean, if in my first job they'd said to me, can you write a discrete simulation of chocolate manufacturing in this factory, I'd have said, no. You know, I'd have found a way of getting out of it, because I didn't know how to do it. And I think that was definitely the case. So I do think what's happened is whether we like it or not, the simple-to-use and not very powerful point-and-click software makes education much easier, actually, in terms of getting stuff to work. It does, however, de-emphasise analysis. And I think a lot of British students come out fairly weak in that area.
Okay. I'm going to ask another topic. Do you have any more to follow up on this?
No,
okay, so how about simulation societies? I mean, how, you know, some countries have simulation societies and you're part of the operational research community, but could you comment about, you know, what you had in terms of societies to support research or conferences or stuff like that in your country?
Small country. If you look at, if you compare the membership of the OR Society with Informs, it's about a population ratio. It's about a 5-to-1 ratio in terms of members and activity. Within, and that really But again, this might be just based on my limited experience. But my limited experience was that the OR Society in the UK has, on and off over the years, had a fairly active simulation group, which I engaged, as soon as I needed to teach simulation, I started to engage with those people, which was the wisest decision I made, I think. But I'm not aware there was ever a simulation society. The OR Society had what's now a special interest group, it was called something different then, in simulation, in discrete simulation. And that organised meetings and would have streams in the conference, that kind of thing. But there was nothing beyond that that I'm aware of.
But they provided the service of some sense, did they, or not?
Yeah, I might be exaggerating it a bit. You see, we're a small country. One thing that struck me when I first came to Wintersim is that some of you guys, the only time you meet is at the annual Wintersim meeting, because you're a big country. Whereas we bump into one another more often. So actually the casual connection is a bit easier. We see it easier for you within a particular state sometimes if you've got a network of universities. But the UK is a small country, lots of people, small country. So actually the big conference thing has never been, in almost all professional disciplines in the UK, annual conferences are not that large, even for medics. To the best of my knowledge, and I'm happy to be corrected, I don't think there's ever been a simulation society. And of course, the word simulation can mean almost anything.
Yeah.
So if you look in the medical literature, you get millions or thousands of hits if you look at it, do some kind of web search. And a lot of this stuff, of course, is mannequins, you know, model patients, pretend patients. It's simulated operating theatres and so on. So a big area of activity there. But the Wintersim type simulation, discrete, and a few other things, I don't think there was a society. I think it was merely
the operational
research,
research society. Yeah. Did they have workshops or anything where researchers come together?
Yes, they did, but they were only occasional. There might be two a year, something like that. And that really, as I say, that's where I came across Docker for the first time, and some of the other people. And started to think of something interesting here rather than something I just had to teach, if you can see the distinction. And so that for me was very useful. You just get to know people, don't you? You just gradually become part of a network and you know who to talk to, you know who to contact, all that kind of stuff. But there's never been a big thing. That group was at its most active about 5 years ago when Simon Taylor and Stuart Robinson were running it. And that had a regular cycle of stuff. So that led to this simulation workshop thing which we have every year, which is very small. It's only about 100 people at most. So there wasn't anything like that, no. Nothing at all. Just a special interest group that met from time to time when people could be bothered. Does that sound? And there wasn't a large academic community. There still isn't in the UK. There's perhaps six or seven places where there's an active amount of research going on in discrete simulation in the UK. Now, it's probably the same in the US, but you just scale it up. With significant research going on.
Well, the German society, ASEM, seems to be fairly...
I know. And the interesting thing there, of course, is it's mainly engineers. Mm-hmm. And in the UK, the engineers have a different take on simulation. And they don't tend to engage with things like Wintersim. Because industrial engineering is not a popular... You won't find industrial engineering used much as a term in the UK. The department I'm in, which is called Management and Science, and we have about 30, it keeps rising, faculty. And we cover OR, ops management, and then a bit of information systems. If we were elsewhere, we were in the States, we'd be industrial engineering, or into ISE probably is what we'd be. But we just don't use those terms in the UK. So engineering in the UK tends to be a bit more, I suppose, hardware oriented, really. And so the manufacturing engineers got involved a bit with simulating manufacturing processes, but it's never been a big thing for them. They'll teach it to their students, but that's it, really. So it's perhaps very different from the States, I think, in that regard. And Germany. Well, Germany, of course, has had this long tradition. Britain, sadly, doesn't have much manufacturing. Whereas, of course, the visit this afternoon is it to a Fraunhofer Institute? It's anyway to a manufacturing institute of some kind. And Germany, ironically, the German manufacturing was put back on its feet by the British after the war. And one of the things that happened was the establishment of these research institutes, the Fraunhofer Institute. Mm-hmm. And the Fraunhofer Institute were essentially applied research bodies linked to universities, but not part of them. And it's typically been fairly high-tech. And an awful lot of simulation work's gone on in those for a manufacturing basis. So a couple of years ago, I was doing a keynote at the German OR conference. And what struck me was how much manufacturing simulation there was compared with the rest of the world. So it's a big thing here. Mm-hmm. And of course, if you're into automated manufacturing, you know, spending $250,000 on a simulation compared with $250 million on the item is a pretty good deal. And so I think that's why it's been much more popular here. Much less activity here in healthcare, for example, simulation, but it's changing. Catching up a bit with the UK and to some extent with the US. So yes, I think it's the engineering base here. Looking around yesterday during the keynote, during one of the plenaries, whatever it was, one thing struck me about the audience, there were very few women. Now, WIC is always heavily male, but I think it's a smaller proportion this year. And I think that's because there's a high proportion of German engineers here. And like it or not, engineering tends to be a male thing. Maybe not in the States, but it is in Western Europe.
Yeah, well, it's changed in the US, it's more changed. Female, but
especially
it's still...
Especially in IE.
Is it really? Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Would be a good thing, too. Mm. So you know, I think the Germany is different. If you look at the other European countries, I'm just flicking around in my mind now. There's been some activity in Spain. There's quite a good group in Madrid. In is it Charles IV, Fifth University in Madrid? There's been a group at the Technical University in Barcelona, and there's been a group on the north coast of Spain, Portugal, some in Porto, France, around the Ecole de Mines, the Grand Ecole de Mines stuff, but there's not been a European simulation community as such.
Well, there's a language issue, probably.
Yeah, but because of you American guys, we all speak English.
All right, well...
Okay.
Okay. I guess I really don't have more questions, but do you have any topics or anything that you think that we haven't touched on that you think is important that we should record for history?
For history, probably not, no. I think there's an issue of scale here, which is, I think, the scale in the UK has always been relatively small compared to the US. And I think that it's clear to me, I think, that the Winter Sim Conference has been absolutely crucial in maintaining a community here in the US, partly because of distance. So to have this excuse to meet, you know, in one sense, careful what I say, in one sense, it doesn't matter about the quality of the papers, in one sense, you know what I mean, because it gets people together to share ideas. And for me, I think that's been the a learning point that, you know, you guys created this conference, not you personally, though you were involved, and that's what's maintained the community. And we don't have that in Western Europe or in Britain.
Okay, I've got one final question. I mean, this is not sort of a retrospective sort of question, but as a sort of a perspective sort of point of view, looking forward, if you have any comments or recommendations to people, young people, who have interests in careers that are centered heavily or concentrated heavily in simulation, what sort of recommendations would you make to them?
Well, I think it depends whether they see themselves as being academics or not, because I think it's increasingly difficult to swap tracks. To swap tracks more than once, anyway. In a sense, if they're interested in the world of practice, then it's all about getting some hands-on experience and learning how to do modelling and learning how to interpret results, and that's just routine stuff. in terms of the world of research, well, of course, it's about finding areas that you can sustain for 10, 15 years. So that means identifying an area where you're going to work for that length of time. I'm not up to speed enough in the analysis area to know where that would be in that area. I suspect at the moment the areas to think about on the modelling side would be probably ABS related, though I have a suspicion that's a passing fashion.
What do you mean by that?
Agent-based.
I have a suspicion that's a passing fashion. And I think there are certain elements of agent-based modelling, which is really the computing community discovering discrete simulation. You just got individual entities that change state. But I think there's an area, a lot of activity going on there, and it's clearly going to be a community that keeps going for some years. So that would be a good place to be if you're interested in the modelling end. The other end, to the computing end, I suspect, is thinking about the, and it sounds terribly trendy, but I think it's quite important, is cloud computing and how that can be exploited in simulation terms. You've got this enormous computing resource, so simulation as a service becomes an issue in business terms now. That you don't buy software anymore, you just rent it. And where it sits is not your concern, as long as you manage the security side of it. So I think that's going to be a big thing for the next few years, and I think will be sustainable for a period. I can't see, famous last words, any significant shift in user interface design. I think we're heavily dependent on whatever the operating system people provide for that. So I can't see that shifting. I can't really see outside the military the parallel and distributed stuff having an enormous impact. You know, it's been the coming thing for 25 years now. Nothing's happened, and I was part of that at one stage. So I think now my ramble would be, at this stage, to help get involved with the agent-based stuff, there's a crying need to link that to decent software, because the software's terrible. And then it would probably be the computing and cloud-based stuff, exploiting that in some way. You know, producing stuff that will run fast enough to use, because you can do cloud-based stuff that's too slow to use. So finding a way of doing that, I think, is quite important. And then it's application stuff. And the application areas at the moment are, in the US and the UK, increasingly healthcare, because you guys, and even more than we, you spend far too much on healthcare.
You think?
Well, you know what I mean.
Is
it 17% of GDP for the US?
Yeah.
It's not sustainable.
Yeah, of course not.
But you do have the... this is nothing to do with this interview. I wrote a paper for something else recently on OR in healthcare, and I've got some OECD figures out. And there's an interesting correlation between people's declared health status, so they ask people how do you feel, and the amount spent in the country. And there's a good correlation. So all the evidence is that US healthcare for the mass of the population is not good, actually, despite the expenditure, but people are more satisfied with it. Rather fascinating. Okay.
Well, anyway, okay, if you don't have more questions, Jim,
I think we'd
like to thank you very much, Mike, for spending time with us and record this as part of our Simulation Archive history.
Please feel free to throw